You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. Wow, that is definitely on. For those of you I don't know, I'm Tamara Wittes, Director of the Center for Middle East Policy here at Brookings. And I'm grateful to all of you for joining us on a busy Monday. It's a special pleasure to welcome you to this event, not only because it's a topic of urgency and enduring interest that demands answers to some tough political and policy challenges for the United States and for other countries around the world. But it's also a special pleasure to have you all here because it is a special occasion for us in the Center for Middle East Policy. It's the occasion to introduce to you our newest visiting fellow, Robert McKenzie. Bobby comes to us with experience studying refugees, talking to refugees in Egypt. He comes to us with service in the State Department as a senior advisor, building partnerships with Arab countries to counter violent extremism, which is driving a portion of these refugee flows. Bobby's a native of my home state of Michigan and holds a PhD in anthropology from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And Bobby will be hosted here at Brookings by our project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world, headed by Will McCants. And he's going to spend his time with us focused on understanding, analyzing, and engaging with Muslim communities in Europe and the United States, including very much around this issue of refugees and more broadly, the civil wars in the region and the impacts they're having on these communities. And it's fair to say, I think, that Syria and the massive wave of refugees now challenging Syria's neighbors, Europe, and the United States has also galvanized organization, activism, humanitarian efforts within the Muslim community in the United States. And that's going to be a focus of Bobby's work as well. And so I'm very grateful to Manal and Riyad Fakhouri for their support in making Bobby's time with us here at Brookings possible. This refugee crisis is, among other things, I think, a reminder that we live in a world in which borders don't mean a heck of a lot, in which what happens halfway around the world affects us here at home. And that trend, that trajectory, has been evident for quite some time, and that's why about 10 years ago, the Brookings Institution began to establish centers overseas. We now have hubs for Brookings globally in Beijing, in New Delhi, and in Doha. And our Doha Center is especially important as a hub for our work covering the multiple crises in the Middle East, convening audiences and experts in the region and bringing people from around the world to the region to hear from regional voices and to help bring Brookings research out to the Middle East. And I'm delighted to share with all of you that the Brookings Doha Center has just completed a new 5-year agreement with the state of Qatar to continue our work there as a hub for Brookings across the Middle East. So those are my business items for this morning, and with that, I would like to welcome Dan Byman and our fantastic panel to the stage. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a second and mic ourselves. Well, let me add my welcome to Tamara's. I'm Dan Byman. I'm the research director here at Brookings of the Center for Middle East Policy. As Tamara said, the refugee issue shows the lack of respect for borders. But what I'll add to that is that it also shows how the politics and realities of every country makes its own refugee issue or problem, if you will, special. And in the United States, I would say it's particularly unusual, especially when you compare it to Europe, because the numbers are relatively small, yet it's become an enormous political issue. And the only thing that perhaps matches the political importance is the remarkable ignorance about the whole situation, about the refugees themselves, about the process of bringing them to the country, and about the reaction on and impact on local Muslim communities. So I'm delighted that we have three great speakers for you on this today. Bobby McKenzie, who's going to be our last speaker, was introduced by Tamara Wittes, so I won't repeat. I'll simply note that he's going to be talking about the impact on U.S. Muslim communities. Our first speaker is Beth Ferris. She is a non-resident senior fellow here in the Project on International Order and Strategy at Brookings. She is also a professor at Georgetown University and a widely recognized expert on refugees, having written widely on the subject and having also been a practitioner working directly with refugees. Our second speaker is Bill Galston, who holds the Ezra Zilka Chair in our Governance Studies program here at Brookings, where he's a senior fellow. He is going to look at the politics of the refugee issue. So while Beth is going to focus on the process and the procedures governing refugees, Bill is going to focus on the politics, and he's held senior political and campaign positions and is a widely recognized expert on domestic policy. So without further ado, let me hand things over to Beth to kick us off, please.
Thanks a lot, Dan, and thanks to all of you for coming out to learn a little bit more about this very complicated process of refugee resettlement in the U.S. I'm going to be fairly boring and really take you through the process and not talk about the politics of it all, which is perhaps the dominant thing that's happening in the U.S., because there are two experts here who will comment on this. But if you look at U.S. policy towards Syrian refugees, it's important to note, first of all, that the U.S. is putting a lot of resources into supporting the governments in the region, those frontline states. It was $4.5 billion since 2011. Last week, another $900 million committed by the U.S. at the London Syria Conference. This is to support the governments that are hosting around 4.5 million refugees. You know, think about tiny Lebanon with a population of 4 million, with over 1 million refugees. So that's kind of the first line of U.S. policy towards Syrian refugees. A second line, and sometimes there's some confusion in the U.S. in understanding how the process of resettlement compares with those who simply arrive on our borders. That process of asylum, we've gotten about 1,500 Syrian asylum seekers in the past couple of years. It is a long and complicated process for Syrians who arrive on our border and say, I'm afraid, don't send me back, let me apply for asylum. The current waiting times are around 2 years to go through all of the paperwork to be recognized as a refugee. But perhaps largely because of the U.S. geographical position, we don't get many asylum seekers. Germany in the past year has had over 1 million simply showing up on our border. For us in the United States, the main way that Syrians have come to the U.S. is through this resettlement process. Now, refugee resettlement, long tradition in the U.S. dating back to the post-World War II era, it is an incredibly bureaucratic, time-consuming, long process by which individuals are identified over there in some other region of the world and brought here. Refugee resettlement to a third country is widely recognized as a third durable solution, affecting perhaps offering solutions to perhaps 1% of the world's 15 million plus refugees. About 28 governments are involved or have some kind of refugee resettlement programs. Each of these programs is different. Different criteria, different procedures. The U.S. takes by far the most refugees for resettlement in the world, equal to about the total of the other 27 countries involved. Refugee resettlement in the U.S. has traditionally enjoyed broad bipartisan support. It was very definitely an instrument of U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War, where refugees were welcomed from countries with whom the U.S. had conflicts. Last year, the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, estimated that 130,000 Syrian refugees needed to be resettlement. Good reasons for them to be moved outside of the region, and asked for commitments of governments to step up and offer resettlement places. They're planning another big meeting the end of March, making a similar call for more resettlement places. There's a lot of misconceptions about the way in which resettlement works. So let me just take you through the process. The first step in the U.S. is the U.S. president makes a determination of how many refugees need to be resettled this year. In recent years, it's been about 70,000 a year, broken down by nationality. So many Africans, so many from Eastern Europe, so many from Asia, and so on. That's down from a high of 225,000 in 1980, but it's been about 70,000 recently. Last year, Secretary of State Kerry announced that it would go up to 85,000 fiscal year 2016, which ends in October. So those are all broken down by regions. Within them, there are different priorities. But the process in the region starts with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which interviews, in most cases, is involved in registering refugees who arrive. UNHCR determines, makes a referral. This is a person who needs resettlement to the U.S. and sends a form. There are multiple forms, dozens of forms going back and forth, paper forms, actually, going back and forth across oceans. But I want you to imagine for a minute that you're in Lebanon, a million Syrian refugees. How do you pick out which 1,000 or 2,000 need resettlement to the U.S.? There are complicated criteria. People who, for various reasons, can't survive in the area and the country in which they found initial refuge. There are certain categories, women at risk who are alone with lots of kids or certain medical conditions. As I said, each of these different resettlement countries has different criteria. For the U.S., the main criteria is this person needs protection that can't be found in the region and therefore should be resettled to the U.S. Now, resettlement takes, they say, 18 months to 2 years. But for Syrians, it's probably at least 2 years in the processing that goes on. So UNHCR begins. The case, they're called cases, the refugee is referred to the resettlement support centers who prepare the file, the documentation, initiate security checks, take the reason, make sure all of the, the pre-screening process is completed. The biographic checks include name checks by the Department of State, consular lookout system, security advisory opinions initiated by the State Department, reviewed by the FBI, other intelligence agencies, interagency checks of biographic information, FBI fingerprint check, Department of Homeland Security automated biometric data system. Once that is done, occasionally concurrently, but once that is done, the Department of Defense Forensics and Biometric Agency checks them. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services reviews all of these different biographies. As I said, this sounds very boring, but it's important to understand these somewhat tedious processes by which security checks are actually made. Unlike some other resettlement countries, the U.S. resettlement program requires an individual interview with an official from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services who travel to various locations to interview individual refugees who've made it this far in the process. These are very experienced asylum officers. They've typically gone through lots of training, heard lots of stories, know when little red flags are raised. If little red flags are raised on the security side, their people are subjected to another round of security, enhanced security season screening. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services then adjudicates the case. No case is approved until the security checks have cleared. Once a person is approved for travel, that resettlement support center, together with the International Organization for Migration, begins processing for actual departure. That includes a medical check, additional security checks, a little bit of cultural orientation, what people can expect in the United States, and actually coming up with the flight arrangements. Every refugee resettled in the U.S. takes out a loan to pay for their flight to the U.S., which they're expected to repay over a period of years. The case is processed. Eventually, the individual gets on the flight, flight manifests again are checked, and the Customs and Border Protection has to sign off on each individual refugee who arrives in the U.S. Finally, a refugee arrives in the U.S. They are greeted and initial reception by a voluntary agency. There are 9 voluntary agencies who participate in this process. These agencies, 6 of which are faith-based, and I used to be head of the Church World Service resettlement program, a Hebrew immigrant. And there's, you know, 9 of these agencies that meet together every week to figure out where individuals should go. This individual has a relative in Detroit, or this individual needs particular services because he or she has been tortured, and there's a good torture support center in Area X. So the voluntary agencies meet every week to plan where the refugees will go. They meet them at the airport. They provide a whole range of services, from helping them get a Social Security card to finding an apartment to job to English language classes. It's really been this unique partnership between these voluntary agencies, many of which mobilize a lot of additional money to facilitate the transition. And the individual, the refugee, is then resettled. So the security checks take a long time. So far, the U.S. has resettled about 2,500 Syrian refugees in the past few years, hopes to do 10,000 by next year. But it is a long, complicated, bureaucratic, and expensive process. The concerns with terrorism and security that I'm sure that she'll talk about. But you know, the fact is there have been a handful of cases where refugees resettled under the U.S. resettlement program have been involved in some kind of terrorist planning or association with radical groups. But in all of those cases, they were radicalized after they arrived in the U.S. They didn't come with the intention of carrying out terrorist activities here or elsewhere. Finally, just to say that the U.S. refugee program, in comparison with other countries, emphasizes getting people to work quickly, having them self-sufficient. And the figures for refugees resettled in the U.S. show that among men, slightly more refugee men are employed than the U.S. population in general, about the same number of refugee women as non-refugee women in the U.S. are employed. Their income tends to increase over time, as you might imagine. They receive about 8 months of Medicaid or health support and other support while they're making their adjustment. But most of them tend to do pretty well after some initial hardship. After a year after they've arrived, they apply for green cards, permanent residency, and then can move on to citizenship. Real differences between groups resettled in the U.S. People who aren't literate in their own language before they're resettled don't do as well, have a harder time finding jobs, kids, as you might imagine, in school. Overall, I would say, I would have said last fall that, you know, the U.S. has a rich tradition of refugee resettlement. You just look at the lists of valedictorians around our country and see the contributions that refugees have made, not just to our economic development, but also to our sense of who we are. I remember I lived in Sweden for a couple of years. I remember meeting an Iraqi refugee. And in Sweden, at that time at least, the refugees got 3 years of full support to learn the language. I was a research director at a peace research institute, and the refugees were getting about the same amount of money I was to learn the language. Swedish is a hard language, but 3 years was quite generous. And this Iraqi refugee said, "Oh, I want to get to the U.S." I said, "Are you crazy? 3 years of support, and your kids get every possible language program in school. Why do you want to come to the U.S.?" He said, "Because in the U.S., I know my kids will be seen as American. I'm not sure they'll be seen as Swedish in Sweden, even after a few years." There is something really special about the tradition we've had in the U.S. refugee resettlement program. And it's really quite painful to see the tortured debates going on right now about security, terrorism, and really putting into question this program that has enriched the lives not only of the 2 million refugees who've been resettled in the United States, but also the sense of who we are as a nation. But I'll turn now to my colleagues to talk about some of the more political realities around this.
Thank you. That's an excellent way for us to begin, I think. Bill, please.
Yeah, and it's a perfect segue, too, because until last fall, public sentiment was very much on your side. And what I'm going to do in 10 minutes is to describe the stages by which public sentiment turned against your side. And I'm going to be making two key points. First, the history history of the Syrian refugee debate in the country over the past 5 months illustrates dramatically the impact of high-profile events on public sentiments. It's one of the most dramatic illustrations of that I think I've seen in quite some time. And secondly, it dramatizes the tension between humanitarian sympathies on the one hand and security fears on the other. And you can understand why public events would strengthen one and weaken the other. So that's the story I'm going to tell, and I have 9 minutes left to tell it, so I will be brisk. I've accumulated a fair amount of survey research on the subject, and it supports the proposition with which you ended. As recently as last September, there was a majority in the United States for accepting the 10,000 refugees on offer and maybe more. And as a more general proposition, 44% of Americans, when asked, said, we really ought to be doing more to help these people. Only 19% said that we should be doing less or nothing. And so 75% of the people, three-quarters of Americans, said we should be doing as what we're doing now or more. There were stark partisan divides on that question. You had about 70% of Democrats taking that position, about 70% of Republicans taking the opposite position. As you went from younger to older voters, there was less support for generous refugee policy. As you went from more educated to less educated voters, support for a generous refugee policy declined. Those internal differences are not surprising. That leads to an interesting question. What does survey research tell us about why the American people as recently as September were willing to take that position? Well, two things jump out at me. First of all, the strength of humanitarian sentiments. And so when you asked, Americans not simply about accepting refugees, but doing more to help them in general, you had three quarters saying that we ought to be much more generous in supporting European search and rescue efforts in the Mediterranean and surrounding areas, and about the same percentage favoring much more direct aid to the refugees in place where they were. Given your account, that's not too surprising. Here is something that's slightly more surprising. You had a solid majority of Americans saying that they felt that way in part because the United States, as well as its allies, bear some responsibility for the refugee crisis. So that's the September baseline. You then move on to the Paris attacks, which were transformative in public sentiments. In the wake of the Paris attacks, a majority turned against accepting any Syrian refugees. Although the anti-refugee sentiments declined somewhat when the detailed vetting processes for entrance were explained in detail, which few of any politicians have bothered to do. And in the wake of the Paris attacks, moreover, there was substantial ambivalence about the extent of U.S. preparation against domestic attacks. This was well before San Bernardino. At the same time, again before San Bernardino, when asked bluntly, which is the greater threat, refugees with terrorist sentiments or homegrown jihadis, 16% chose the refugees, and 58% homegrown jihadis. That was before San Bernardino, so the people were already weighing and balancing the fears. Well, after San Bernardino, another transformative moment. This is a three-stage story. Here's an interesting fact for you. At the end of the year, the people were asked, what were the top two defining news events of the year for you personally? Not for the country, for you personally. Number one on the list was Paris. Number two was San Bernardino. These events really broke through to the consciousness of the American people. These were not episodic events. These were events that endured in memory and changed opinions. I can illustrate that vividly. As recently as last April, you had about 20% of the American people picking national security and terrorism as their top issue. By December, just a couple of months ago, that had doubled to 40%. 20% to 40%. It transformed not only public consciousness, but also the balance of discussion within the presidential primaries, and especially on the Republican side. It also redefined attitudes towards internal security measures. By December, when people were asked, well, which worries you more, that we will go too far internally and invade civil liberties, or that we won't go far enough and permit, you know, some more internal terrorist plans to go undetected. You had 40% expressing fears for civil liberty, and the rest, the majority, expressing fears we would overlook some potential threats. In conclusion, and this exceeds my brief just a little bit, but heck, you know, this is a foreign policy panel. You also had, in the wake of Paris and San Bernardino, increased support for more forceful action against terrorists abroad. And, you know, for example, in the most recent, you know, NBC Wall Street Journal survey, it was made public, which was not unfortunately this week's, which is still secret, but last month's, when people were asked, well, do you favor military action? Just about everybody did. When you were asked, well, if you had to choose between military action involving only airstrikes or military action that included combat troops in addition to airstrikes, more people were in favor of the latter than the former. There is a basis of support for combat troops against ISIS, and in the face of our bitter experience in the Middle East up to now, that is a remarkable development. Indeed, when the question was bluntly asked, do you support or oppose ground troops to fight ISIS in Iraq and Syria, 54% of Americans said that they favored it, including 71% of Republicans and 53% of independents, but almost 4 in 10 Democrats as well. That's a surprisingly high number for a party that elected a president in large measure because he was, he said, a peacemaker who was elected to end wars and not begin them. Why do the American people think this? Well, when asked directly, do they think the United States and its allies are winning or losing the fight against ISIS? 23% thought we were winning, and about 3 times that many thought we were losing. And it's pretty clear that the American people don't want to lose to the terrorists, in part because they have been forced to discard the illusion, to go back to Tamara Wittes's opening comments, that what happens in Syria stays in Syria. There's no Las Vegas foreign policy available to us anymore. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let me turn it over to our last speaker. Bobby, please.
Great. I'd like to just begin by thanking Tamara Wittes for the very nice and kind introduction. I want to thank Dr. Will McCants in the back, my colleague and immediate boss, and I want to thank all of you for being here. We had a public event here on Friday, and it was a very similar-sized room, and so it suggests to me that there is a strong appetite to learn more about the situation that's going on right now. For today's talk, I want to talk about four things in linear fashion. One, the impact of the over-the-top rhetoric that's having on Muslim Americans. Secondly, I want to ask, will anti-Muslim sentiments make jihadi groups more appealing, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy? Three, I want to discuss how has this rhetoric changed Muslims, Americans' political engagement. And then finally, I've been instructed by Tammy to come up with some policy solutions to fix all of this. So in my final stretch here, I'm going to tell us how we should fix all this if the administration will just listen. So let me just start here by reading through a list, and if you could just bear with me. Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Mississippi, Ohio, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, North Carolina, North Dakota, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. These are the 30 states, where governors have said that they will suspend refugee resettlement. And you can only imagine if you were a Muslim in one of those states, if you were a Muslim youth in one of those states. You can only imagine if you were a refugee that was resettled to one of those states. So when people ask, is this just rhetoric? I would offer it's not only rhetoric, it's having policy implications. And these are 30 examples. It's not clear that these governors will have the legal authority to actually do anything. But it is clear that this over-the-top rhetoric isn't without consequences. And I just want to juxtapose something that was said by Beth here, that, you know, you've got 6.5 million internally displaced Syrians. You have another 4.5 million Syrian refugees. And the U.S. has taken in the neighborhood of 2,500 since the uprising. Not 2,500 a day, not a week, not a year, 2,500 total. The state of Michigan has taken 250 total. We have an infrastructure there. We have 500,000 Muslims who live in southeast Michigan, and Michigan has only taken 250 Syrian refugees. And guess what? There is strong pushback at all levels in the state of Michigan for taking one single more refugee. And so I think that this discussion is important. And I was at a meeting last week where someone was talking about the mechanics and the logistics of being difficult to bring more refugees here. I can assure you that the mechanics and the logistics don't matter much if we can't get political buy-in on the state level. And so I want to, if we look back over the last year here and the political debate here, we've heard about Syrian refugees talked about as a Trojan horse. Chris Christie has said that he wouldn't even take a 3-year-old Syrian orphan. That we should only take Christian refugees. And so what I think we're seeing here is a shift that it's not just about refugees, it's also about their religious identity. And these things are being gummed together in ways that are very, very dangerous. The level of bigotry, xenophobia, far exceeds anything of 9/11. I spent the last year and a half traveling across Michigan, Illinois, New York, Florida, Texas, California, talking to Muslim leaders. And without question, everyone's saying what we're seeing today is much worse than what we saw in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And this should deeply concern us. The question is, you know, is there a real concern? Are anti-Muslim sentiments possible to make jihadi groups more appealing? And I think we should look at some of the numbers. Let's look at the U.S. since 9/11. We've taken 784,000 refugees. Do you know how many have been arrested for terrorist activities? 5. Let me say those numbers again. 784,000 refugees since 9/11. 5 have been arrested for terrorist activities. Now let's look at the Muslim community post 9/11. Since 9/11, 45 deaths have been the result of Muslims, 45 that are linked to terrorism. If we want to look at that compared to, juxtapose that to far right-wing individuals, 48 deaths. And yet, if you watch the news, if you listen to some of the political rhetoric, henny penny, the sky is falling, that there is a Muslim terrorist around every corner. And the numbers don't bear that out. And I think that this is important that we contextualize this discussion with the numbers. So I've talked a little bit about the negatives here. Let me talk about some of the positives that in fact these negatives have driven. Muslim communities across the country are mobilizing in ways that they never have before. So in places like Michigan, you see voter registration and voter mobilization like never before. You've got folks doing phone banking in different languages, in Urdu and in Arabic, trying to reach older voters. You've got youth going out trying to get other youth to vote. And you also have fundraising on a level that's never been seen either. So, for example, the Syrian community, to use just one example, has three bundlers across the entire country, only three, and they are very disciplined. One is for a Democratic candidate and two are for two Republican candidates. Syrians who are giving money give only to these bundlers because they want to make sure that their voices are heard. This was not happening 10 or 15 years ago. You also have the Syrian community engaging with other faith-based communities in ways that are unique. You now have Syrian Americans who are traveling to Israel to talk to Israeli officials. This wasn't happening 10 or 15 years ago, and I think there's a lot to be learned for this. While they are mobilizing, I would offer that they are not quite there yet in terms of voting. Their voting numbers are still, voting percentage rather, are still very, very low. But it's definitely increasing, and there's no question if there is one silver lining in this toxic political discourse, it's the fact that communities are organizing in very structured ways. And another positive that I'd like to point out here is, with special reference to the Syrian American communities, they have formed four or five heavyweight organizations across the country that have collectively distributed over $300 million in aid to frontline countries and to Syria. And this is possible because of the conflict and because of their concern about the direction of things. And so finally, I want to turn to some policy recommendations. And this gets, I think that these are pretty simple things to do, and I'd like to see the administration do more of it. Obama's visit to the mosque in Maryland, I think, was vital, but it was long, long overdue. But I don't think it's enough. And I think visiting a mosque, I think holding roundtables are fine. They're symbolically important. They're optically important. But I think that he would do better, the administration would do better, if they identified and amplified stories of, you know, some of the extraordinary efforts that are going on across the country by Muslim Americans. Let me just cite a few here that you may or may not know about. Because of the Flint water contamination crisis, Muslims have mobilized in Michigan, raised money, and provided 30,000 bottles of water to poor Flint residents. In January of 2015, Muslim organizations in southeast Michigan raised over $100,000 to pay the water bills of poor Detroiters. They didn't do this with the flag of Islam flying. They did this because they are citizens of southeast Michigan, and they were concerned about poor Detroiters. That's it, full stop. Also, there are Muslim communities that are raising a not insignificant amount of money to try and revitalize very specific neighborhoods in Detroit. These are the kinds of stories that I just think aren't known. They're not, but they should be told. I was in Tampa a year and a half ago for an event in inner city Tampa, and the Muslim community there collected over 5,000 used bicycles to give to poor kids living in the inner city. No one knows about this. We don't hear about this. These sorts of stories should be identified and amplified by the administration. The other kinds of stories that I think, I'm giving you some extraordinary stories, the other kinds of stories that I think need to be identified are those of refugees. I mean, we've taken nearly 3 million refugees since over the last 30 years. We've taken 750,000 refugees since 2001. It would be really good for the American public to hear about some of these stories, and I don't think we hear enough about them. And finally, I just wanted to say that I was a little bit hard on some of the Republican candidates, but I also think that just a word of caution for the Democratic candidates. It's not enough to visit a mosque. I think the candidates have to be very careful to decouple any discussion about Muslim engagement and empowerment with countering violent extremism. It happens too often. We need to be engaging the Muslim community because we live in a pluralistic and open society, because they're American citizens who are contributing in all kinds of ways, not because we're worried about if we don't engage with them, that individuals from that community might become more susceptible to violent extremism. So those are my very simple policy recommendations to fix the situation. But again, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here, and I'll turn it back over to Dan.
Thank you. That's, I think, excellent closing. Before we open it up to the audience, what I'd like to do is kick off our discussion with a question for each of you. Beth, I'll ask you to begin, which is, you described a fairly, Byzantine, labyrinthine, let's put it as comprehensive might be a polite word, system of rules and regulations that will govern when people come in. The Obama administration has at least made noises that they want to streamline this process. Are there a couple things we could get rid of that, ignoring politics for a moment, but just that would, you know, these procedures are not necessary, they're counterproductive. Are there ways we could streamline it to move this from, you know, 80 years to 2 years or something more realistic given what you think is feasible?
You know, a year ago there was a real commitment on the part of the Department of State and others to streamline the process, and there are lots of ways it could be streamlined. You could have some of these security checks occur concurrently instead of waiting for, you know, one to be finished before the next one begins. But most of those have been dropped or sidelined given the intensity of the political debate. Now we're kind of grasping onto those and saying, look at how careful all these processes are. Terrorists couldn't get through. You know, so I think that maybe there'll be a time for discussion of streamlining a little later when some of the hysteria goes down. But right now, I think most of those proposals are on hold. Most refugee advocates, most of those involved in refugee resettlement would really like to see this process streamlined. In Canada, it takes about 4 months. 4 months, 24 months. I mean, Canada took 25,000 refugees in the space of a few months. The U.S. has shown that it can mobilize amazing resources when necessary to process and move people quickly. And I think that there were the political will to do that. I'm confident we could do that for far, far larger numbers. Could I just say one other thing, Daniel? When you think about the difficulties in resettlement, I think we need to look beyond resettlement as a way of helping Syrians get out of the region and relieving some of the pressure on these host governments. It's an enormous failure of responsibility or burden sharing when a million people are going to Germany and very few governments are stepping up to say, well, we can help. But United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is organizing a meeting next month called Alternative Safe Pathways for Syrians. Maybe the answer isn't to change our resettlement system, but to have 1,000 universities in the U.S. offer 10 scholarships to Syrian students. Look for ways of expanding family reunification that, given the situation, maybe Syrians could bring not only their children and moms, but maybe their uncles or their aunts or their cousins, or some way of using traditional immigration channels instead of relying on this Byzantine. Or maybe there are labor migration schemes, allow people to come for a year or two to work and go back to the region and bringing with them some skills that they can use for what we hope will eventually be rebuilding of Syria. So I think we need to look beyond resettlement as a way of encouraging and enabling Syrians to find other solutions.
Thank you. Bill, can I follow up on Beth's point about the politics and the political will? In 10 months, we will have, or 10 months, excuse me, in 11 months, we will have a new president or a new president-elect. Is this sentiment basically a permanent or at least medium-term change? Or do you think that really the kind of election season has altered the debate, but when the election season goes away, we might come back to, we might revert to the, you know, pre-September, pre-Paris mindset on this?
I'm going to surprise you with some good news. I think it's much more the latter, much more likely to be the latter than the former. And I think that not because I've had the opportunity to travel through Muslim communities in the United States and to talk to people, but because of the high quality survey data available on this and related questions. And let me just give you a flavor of it. Why, you know, although I'm prone to pessimism on many, many subjects, I can't quite bring myself to succumb on this one. In the immediate wake of 9/11, The percentage of Americans expressing negative views of Muslims was 29%. 5 years ago, it was 28%. Today, it's 29%. In the meantime, the percentage of Americans expressing positive views of Muslims has risen from 47% to 59%. And the percentage of Americans expressing very favorable views of Muslims has doubled. So the aggregate evidence for a surge of Islamophobia is not robust. Now, that doesn't gainsay, you know, granular ground-level experience, but it does suggest that there hasn't been a sea change in American public attitude. So that's point number one. Here's point number two. Let's talk about this Trump exclude all Muslims proposal, which has already been mentioned in this discussion. One of the best survey research firms that I know, Peter Hart, who teamed up with Republican Bill McInturff, does the survey research for NBC Wall Street Journal, put that question directly to him a month ago. And 25% of Americans said that they were in favor of that proposal, 25%. 57% said they opposed it, and the rest were unsure. Now, I suppose you could look at that as a glass half empty story on the grounds that, any right-thinking American should have rejected it outright as being totally inconsistent with who we are. I could get out of bed and say that, but I have to say that at the height of the furor, the fact that you only had a quarter of Americans willing to go anywhere near the Trump proposal with a 10-foot pole tells me that this may be the silly season, but it's not quite as silly as the newspaper coverage of primary politics would suggest. So I don't think that the events of the past 5 months have fundamentally and permanently changed who we are or what our outlook is, but it has, in the short term, had a very destabilizing effect on the national conversation and, I would imagine, on the experience on the ground of Muslim Americans.
Sure. I'm tempted to end our event right now so we can all be happy. But I do have a question for Bobby, which is when we talk about Muslim Americans like any other religious or ethnic community, we're, of course, talking about an extremely diverse community.
Yes.
Are there major divisions on this issue or on other issues we've discussed? Are there ways you would kind of take one step back and say this part of the community might believe X or Y or prioritizes this?
Sure. And if we want to even look at Southeast Michigan, for example, and talk about bringing Syrian refugees there, if one were to go to Dearborn or Dearborn Heights, where I'm from, where there is a large Lebanese Shia community, which is also mobilizing, they have different views about resettlement of Syrian refugees. And they also bundle money, and they also are active in getting out voters. So I would say that it's not across the board in terms of let's bring all the Syrian refugees here. I'd like to just respond quickly to, I think, Bill's excellent remark about the aggregate not bearing out that things are worse than 9/11, and I don't contest that at all. But what I would be very interested in looking at is polling data that's directed at Muslim communities, because the anthropologist in me that likes to do ethnography, when I talk to Muslims, now I don't contest at all that your average American might have warmer, fuzzier, happier feelings about the Muslim community. When I talk to Muslim communities across the country, they're very concerned about this toxic discourse.
Sure.
And so I think that that is something that I'm seeing. And I also wanted to just chime in about, I think, Beth's very excellent point about maybe we need to think differently about how to help refugees. And one group of folks that I don't think is tapped enough are Syrian Americans who are involved in extraordinary effort. I flagged up that they are, distributing over 300 million in aid. These Syrian Americans not only have expertise on a variety of topics, they also have networks on the ground. And I think we would do well to ask, the government would do well to ask, how can we better engage them to think about helping displaced persons and refugees? So,
Thank you. Now, let me open up to the audience. Let me simply ask that you wait for the microphone and briefly just say your name and any other title, please. Great. Yes, let's begin in the front right here, please.
Herb Rose. I'm very impressed with the explanation as to the extensive vetting process. I had not heard all those details before. I was also impressed with some of the numbers that you came up with that you're polling. What I do wonder about is, has any polling been done since the middle of January after the story broke, perhaps not as widely as Paris or San Bernardino, as to what happened on New Year's Eve in Cologne and some of the other large cities in Northern Europe?
Does anyone know?
If such polling has been done in this country, I'm quite sure it's been done in Europe and especially Germany, but if polling has been done on that particular question in this country, I'm unaware of it. I can't discount the possibility that it may have moved the needle a little bit, but just casual observation suggests to me that the coverage here of that episode and related episodes in Europe was nothing like the wall-to-wall coverage of Paris and San Bernardino. And, you know, Ed, one of the standard maxims of news impact is that for most people who are paying only casual attention to events like that, it needs to be a multi-day headline story to break through and change public sentiment. And I don't think in this country the coverage of events in Cologne and elsewhere rose to that level.
Yes, yeah.
Eva Havas, I wonder if any of you could comment on if we don't do more to solve the refugee crisis, how much is that going to push Europe even more to the far right?
Would anyone like to take a stab on the European side?
Yeah, I think what you see in Europe is that the large number of arrivals, the dismal prospects for any peace solution soon that would enable people to go back, growing resentment triggered, you know, manifest perhaps in the Cologne experience, but, you know, the welcome is wearing thin. People have been there for a long time. This happens in every refugee situation. Warm generosity, people are welcomed, and after a while you get worried about the schools and public services and the costs and the differences, and I think we're seeing that now. But if you think about what's going to happen, what happens if people can't go back? What happens if more come? I mean, the news from Aleppo and elsewhere is such, suggesting that we're going to see more people moving. Do we really want to see walls going up at these borders and desperate people trying to get away from barrel bombs who can't escape? I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine what's going to happen next. Will Europe step up and come up with some kind of coordinated way of sharing the burden of refugees? I haven't seen a lot of positive signs of that burden sharing, but maybe it would happen. You know, what's going to happen if we don't see a more robust international response? I think it's terrifying, with implications not just for the Middle East and for Europe, but it's a global issue, and I don't think America can really stand on the sidelines too much longer. And Dan, if I could just make a comment or ask Bill for his reaction, but I'm struck by how fickle the media is. You remember that picture of the little boy on the beach in early September? Just this outpouring of generosity and solidarity. I know my phone was ringing off the hooks for weeks, and individuals, how can I take a Syrian refugee? I've got an extra bedroom. You know, all that just went up in a flash after Paris. Is my perception wrong? I mean, it seemed like it was such a dramatic about face.
You know, the news media notoriously are a roving searchlight. You know, that's their DNA. Let me just add one point on your question. The reason that I think that this is more serious than previous episodes, and not just a repeat of them, is that it occurs against a backdrop of political instability and economic stagnation throughout the European Union. And so this refugee crisis has hit at the worst possible time because people who are scared about their livelihoods already are not likely to be in an enduringly generous mood. And some of what's going on in this country during the presidential campaign is a reflection of the fact that median wages are no higher now than they were a decade ago, and you know, median household incomes are lower than they were 15 years ago. So public generosity tends to rise sharply when times are good and people are feeling secure economically and in other ways, which helps explain the 1960s in this country and the surge of generous economic and social legislation. This is the worst possible time to ask people, average people, working class and middle class people, to be generous, even though from a moral point of view, you can strongly defend that proposition.
I would just chime in that it's not only Europe that's being overwhelmed. It's also the frontline states. I mean, half of Syria's population is displaced. Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon are overwhelmed. Even if there were peace today, if you see pictures of homes in other cities, there's no returning home. And so the refugee crisis will continue unabated for 10, 15, 20 years. This is a fact. And so I think it's important to think about what are some of the solutions because, I mean, look at homes. No one is returning there anytime soon.
Yes. One sec, please. Yes.
Thank you for a great presentation. I'm Elliot Hurwitz. I'm a former World Bank and State Department and intelligence community person. Would anyone on the panel like to say what are the solutions to the refugee problem that's going to go on for 10 or 15 or 20 years?
That's a pretty tall order. We are focused on the U.S. side today, so I'll ask if you have additional thoughts on what to do on the U.S. side, please.
Sure. I, from a 50,000-foot view, just to respond to that, I mean, as long as the conflict continues, the refugee flows will continue. This is a fact. And so what the U.S. has to think about is how many refugees can we take? As I said earlier, the state of Michigan, Southeast Michigan, has an infrastructure to take a large number of refugees. We've taken 250 Syrians. 250. It's mind-boggling. And so, but I'm not sure it's politically tenable either to try and take 100,000 Syrian refugees. I know our governor of Detroit, Mike Duggan, who's hyper-competent and very capable, moving difficult political pieces forward, has not been able to push this forward. And so from the U.S. perspective, I don't know how we're going to get more Syrian refugees here if it's not politically tenable. So I think it's a very difficult space. So we're going to see more refugees. I mean, just as of last week, I think there's 70,000 displaced persons from Aleppo who are at the border.
And they're still at the border. And there are some indications that the Turks may open their doors, but they're in no hurry to do so. That's obvious. But let me just add another option, or at least another consideration. In my judgment, we are paying dearly, and so is Europe, for our collective failure to create and to sustain safe zones in Syria. We could have done it, in my judgment, at an affordable price. If we had, those 70,000 people or 50,000 people on the border would have a place to go right now other than Syria, and they would be protected because we would be protecting them. So, you know, so inaction is not always the safest course, but that's the policy we've pursued, and I don't think history is going to look kindly on us.
So as not to end on a terribly depressing note, I have tremendous confidence in refugees. Refugees being able to find their own solutions, to become self-reliant, to somehow blend in and make a living in what's likely to be the host countries. I mean, that the single thing that would help the most for refugees is to give them the right to work legally. In most countries, they're, you know, working underground, but very, very vulnerable to exploitation and just making a not anywhere near as much as they could if they could participate fully in the labor market, which is very difficult for these host countries that, you know, face their own economic pressures. But if there's something the U.S. could do or the international community could do with Lebanon and Jordan, and could say, you know, realizing what an impact this would have, but is there some way we could make it easier? Let Syrian school teachers start working, for example, sector by sector, or establish special economic zones, or provide tangible benefits to allow refugees to work. I think that could have a real impact on the quality of life of people living in the region.
Thank you, please. Tamara, please.
So I want to go back to a contrast I heard between
Okay. I want to go back to a contrast I heard between the two of you with respect to attitudes in American society toward Muslims and toward Syrian refugees more specifically, and push you a little bit beyond the poll numbers, if I may, Bill.
Sure.
Because it would be great to be heartened by the fact that a majority of Americans are rejecting these Islamophobic proposals by some of the guys running for president. And that the numbers in the poll data of hostility toward Muslims haven't increased dramatically. But what has increased dramatically is the number of hate crimes recorded against Muslim Americans in this country. We've seen a 100% jump. Mm-hmm. So there's an intensity of sentiment. There's a sense among people who hold those views that it's a permissive environment in which to act out. Or at least that they feel so strongly they can't help themselves. And there is a direct impact on American citizens, including some who are mistaken for Muslims. My question, though, so first of all, we have this disparity in the data, which I think has to take us beyond broad attitudes to intensity of attitudes and what does it mean. But in addition to that, part of what's challenged here is our sense of what America is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we've defined ourselves by our civic nationalism and also by our sense of we are a haven and we are a city on the hill, even without a dramatic surge in attitudes pushing in the other direction, you do have a trend that's very intense that seeks to, it seems to me, define what Americans are in a very different way, and we see that playing out in our election season. So I wonder if you can respond to that a bit.
Well, stepping back a little bit and taking a broader historical view, attitudes towards refugees and immigration more broadly have waxed and waned throughout our history. You know, it suffices to recall the surge of Irish into the United States in the 1830s and 40s, which sparked the creation of the Know Nothing Party, which bears a remarkable resemblance. I actually went back and read some history, you know, to some of the things that are being said and done right now. After the surge of immigrants between 1880 and 1920 from new places, Southern Europe, lots of Jews, lots of Italians, and lots of Slovaks, we slammed the immigration gates shut for 41 years between 1924 and 1965. So I hesitate to draw any straight line projections from current events. Let me just express confidence based more on history than the present that this sense of who we are is so deep. Civic nationalism as contrasted to ethno-nationalism or theocratic nationalism, that I don't think what's going on now is nearly powerful enough to change that. Now, having said that, I'm in no position to deny the outbreak of hate crimes. Yes, I know those numbers too. And you know, nor would I dream of denying the impact that that can have on communities of people who are targeted. No one Jewish, which is what I am, can overlook or underestimate the impact of such events when politicians anywhere, however unrepresented they may be, express anti-Semitic sentiments, if there are hate crimes directed towards Jewish cemeteries, for example, however unrepresentative they may be of broader sentiments in that country or that community, they have a huge impact on the sense of security and the sense of community of people who were targeted. So I see, I see no contradiction between the broad swath of public attitudes on the one hand and at the grassroots level, how communities justifiably respond when they're the victims of such sentiments, and also what intensity of antipathy can do to stimulate such events. So I think it all fits together, but it doesn't lead to an enduringly pessimistic conclusion about the future of the United States.
I just wanted to chime in on this. I think it's an excellent question, Tammy, about our sense of what America is, who we are, and not to belabor my policy point about telling, identifying and amplifying stories of Muslim Americans, but a poll yesterday said that 52% of Americans don't know a Muslim. And I would guess that 95% of Americans have never been in a mosque that are non-Muslims. And so I think it's really important to humanize, Muslim communities. They're like any other community. I mean, it's a continuum. You have some who are very religious and some who aren't religious at all. It's a label. And I think Americans need to hear more of these stories. And I think the Muslim communities would appreciate that these stories are told, because there are so many, Muslim Americans who are contributing in all kinds of ways that have nothing to do with religion. And I think it would be very, very helpful for folks to hear about this. And if you want to read an interesting story that was that ran in the Washington Post in the last couple of months, it looked at Hamtramck in southeast Michigan. Hamtramck used to be a very large Polish community, and it now has a large Muslim community. And what the story tells is that familiarity doesn't necessarily improve relations, sometimes quite the opposite. And this has been sort of my view in southeast Michigan. Even though you have incredible diversity, there are a lot of misconceptions. And there's a lot of misunderstandings, and people think that, we're being flooded with refugees. And so I think that it would, we don't just need the Obama administration, we also need some leadership on the Republican side to also stand up and say, Muslim Americans are Americans. And I remember Colin Powell stating pretty powerfully about the idea of a Muslim, being president. I mean, his response essentially was, so what? And he talked about Muslim Americans having fought and died for this country. And so I think that, we don't need to tell those extreme examples, but of the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers, and so on. So, yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Do you have a question? Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. My name is Irini Shila. I come from Greece. I'm professor of international politics in Pantheon University. And I am in a sabbatical here in the States. So my question is, what are the prospects of a Euro-Atlantic cooperation in this issue, and especially concerning the countries which have a very big economic and financial crisis like Greece? I agree with you that the refugee crisis, the refugee problem, is a global one, and also an internal one. In Greece, the last month, we faced a big problem with all these arrivals. And I'm wondering, and I would like to know your opinion in that issue. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you again to kind of focus on the U.S. side of that question, because we've had other events on the European side. So does anyone want to?
Yeah, just a very short comment. I just talked with some German officials this past week, and their response has been, if the U.S. could just take 100,000 Syrian refugees a year, it would help them immensely. And I don't see that happening. And maybe my colleagues here see things moving differently. And I'm talking about 100,000 in addition to the 70,000 that we already take every year. So, you know, from the U.S. side, I mean, we're only going to see 10,000 is the bump. And that, I think, is the best we're going to see, and especially in this particular election cycle. We one can hope that after November, that the scope for the conversation will expand. But I think up until November, I don't think we're going to hear about larger numbers.
But it does have implications for the Transatlantic Alliance at a time when Europe needs support, particularly Germany and Italy and Greece and other countries experiencing large numbers of arrivals, at a time when they need that international transatlantic support. It isn't there. And maybe there are other things the U.S. could do, but I don't see the U.S. taking large numbers of refugees, which would be helpful to Europe, not just in terms of the numbers, but in showing that this is a global phenomenon. It isn't just the country to which refugees arrive that's responsible. It should be a global responsibility, and so far we don't see that kind of global sense of burden sharing or responsibility sharing. I think it's really bad for the Transatlantic Alliance.
Yes, please.
Hello, Eleanor Bachrach. I have a couple of questions about the Syrians, both overseas and here. Overseas, the refugees, we've certainly heard that some of them are professionals. Do we have any idea of the demographic breakdown of the refugee community, whether it's representative of the country as a whole or what? Second, in terms of support here from the Syrian community. I know I can think of at least one wealthy Syrian Jewish community. Is there support for Syrians there or just from the Syrian Muslims, or don't you know?
Sure.
Go ahead, please, Beth.
Yeah, I don't have the data on the demographic breakdown. There is some data available. I think it's on UNHCR's website. It changes constantly. You know, I don't know whether or not professionals are overrepresented among refugees. Certainly some of the refugees that my colleague and I, Kamal Karici, and I met on the Turkish border were very well educated. We've met a group of 12 orthodontists. I mean, who would think of Syrian orthodontists seeking refuge living in very minimal conditions? There are a lot of well-educated Syrians looking for opportunities to use their skills and talents. And, you know, Syria is a middle-income country, very high levels of literacy, for example. If you want to answer the question about the Syrian.
Yeah, with regard to the U.S., while you hear certain individuals running for office advocate that we only take Christian refugees, what you're seeing amongst Syrian groups is that they are ready and willing to work with other faith-based groups. So, for example, the Chaldean community, Iraqi Christians in southeast Michigan, there's a few hundred thousand, and they are, you know, thought partners with the Syrian community. Both the Muslim and Christian communities to think about the ways in which to improve the resettlement of refugees here. But the biggest obstacle right now is just getting refugees resettled in the U.S. because the numbers have been so small. But what I've seen is that you've got Syrian Muslim communities who are collaborating with other faith-based groups, including in Michigan, in particular in Michigan, Jewish communities, to think about how more refugees can, when they're resettled here, how they can best integrate. So,
in the very back.
I have one question, but also a short story. My name is Leanne Dorsey. The short story is just to highlight a small village in Montgomery County that invited 3 Syrian Americans to come on a Sunday afternoon and talk to anybody who wanted to hear more about Muslims, Syrians, Syrian refugees, the situation in Syria. It was a very worthwhile activity, and I recommend it to anybody. And the second was the local government of Montgomery County, who wrote a letter to the to Health and Human Services saying, despite what you may hear from our governor, we welcome Syrian refugees. also a very worthwhile activity, I think. But my question to you is, the three of you have done an excellent job of presenting the facts, figures, and processes that make it, along with our values at the core of our nation, a no-brainer to increase our welcome and numbers of Syrian refugee resettlement. What can we do to get what you are saying out as the message, as opposed to the xenophobic sound bites of presidential candidates and politicians?
Yeah.
Well, I'll answer that question just for myself and very tersely. I write a weekly column for the Wall Street Journal. I have written repeatedly about this subject, and I don't intend to stop.
Yeah, let me just 2 points here. I think it's an excellent story when you that you highlighted where the three Syrian refugees came and talked about, or the three Syrians rather came in to talk about refugees and Muslims. I can give you another quite different example, which is in Oakland County, which is one of the tri-counties in southeast Michigan, again, where you've got a lot of Muslims. The county executive, a gentleman by the name of L. Brooks Patterson, did everything humanly possible to obstruct the efforts to resettle Syrian refugees to Pontiac, Michigan, which is a city that has lost its population over the years. And while they're going to resettle refugees there, it's been very, very hard. But I think back to Bill's point in terms of how do you get these stories out there. It's events like these and more of them. I'm looking at tomorrow right now. And I think the more that people hear about these things, I think the better. And certainly those that have a platform to reach a much wider audience, I think it's very, very important.
And I think it's important. It isn't just audiences like this who kind of self-select to come to a program on Syrian refugees, but where are our faith communities? Where are the churches and the synagogues and the women's groups and the Lions clubs? And that's one of the richnesses of the U.S. is this array of civil society groups that would provide a forum for discussing these with those who aren't already sympathetic, to talk to Syrians, to hear about what's happening in the community. I think is really the way to go.
Yes, in front here, please.
So, two questions, just to play devil's advocate a little bit. The first question is, and maybe I'm misremembering the specific statistic, but that the U.S. resettled 70,000 refugees last year, which is more than every other country in the world combined in terms of overseas refugee resettlement. So we're talking about hand-wringing and is the U.S. doing enough? Isn't it, can we take a stop, like a moment here, and pat ourselves on the back for resettling more refugees than every other country in the world combined? And then the other question, too, is we're going to take 10,000 Syrians this year out of our 85,000 cap this year. And we're talking about, should we raise it to 100,000, blah, 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 blah. And so here's the question. When we have, however many, a million Somalis in Kenya who've been waiting there for 15 years. We have Rohingyas drowning in off the coast of Malaysia and Thailand in little boats because their country doesn't give them citizenship. Why are we taking, the entire number of all of these other refugee populations and investing all of our resources in Syrians as opposed to the 50, 60 million other displaced people around the world? Is there just from a policy level? So I guess two questions are, one, can we take a moment and say, we've done an okay job resettling refugees. Maybe we could do more, but we've done an okay job. And two, why specifically should the focus be on Syrians? And is it perhaps because it's a timely and interesting issue that there's been so much particular focus on them?
Beth, can you start?
Yeah, definitely we should be proud of our program of refugee resettlement. It isn't just 70,000, but it's cumulative numbers. And I think we've been enriched by it. It's been a great experience, and we can do more. In terms of numbers, out of the 85,000, 25,000, the largest group were designated for Africa and from a variety of countries. Southeast Asia, 13,000. Europe, 4,000. Near East and South Asia, including Syria, 34,000. So it's the second largest category. But historically, the U.S. refugee program has responded both to pressing need for resettlement. And this is a case where I think resettlement can prove be a very strategic choice in enabling countries like Germany and Greece and Lebanon and Jordan to feel some international support, really beyond the sheer numbers of people involved. And also it's been an instrument of U.S. foreign policy, you know, to support countries where people need to be moved. And in Syria, I think that there is a case to be made that it's in U.S. national interest to help relieve some of the refugee burden on countries in the region. And therefore, but Syrians are by no means, you know, 15,000 out of 10,000 out of 85,000 is not a great percentage.
If I could just, you know, and this is not intended to be a slam dunk policy argument. It's simply a different way of looking at the facts. Historically, you're absolutely right. But my understanding is that Germany, with a population of about a quarter ours, took in excess of 700,000 last year.
Sorry. All right.
Well, but I promise you that a very substantial percentage of the people who knocked on Germany's doors will end up staying there for an extended period of time, if not the rest of their lives. And there's some preliminary statistics indicating that there's a substantial admixture of asylum seekers from other countries, countries other than Syria and Iraq. There are a fair number of Afghanis, lots of others too. And those people are going to have weaker claims, but I think the preliminary numbers will bear out the projection that probably half of them will end up remaining in Germany and other European recipient countries for quite some time, if not indefinitely. So I think we should consider what we should do to some extent independently of what others are doing. And there's, and on a realist note, I also want to suggest, and this is in line with the points you made in your presentation, Beth, that in addition to a humanitarian ingredient of refugee policy, there's also a geopolitical ingredient. Mm-hmm. From a humanitarian standpoint, all refugees are created equal. But there are other standpoints from which some potential refugee populations represent a more urgent problem for the United States, thinking to its own long-term national interest. I don't know where that leaves us, but those are just some considerations.
Just real quickly, I mean, there are 60 million refugees worldwide, and we're talking about a very small number that we're taking to the U.S. That's the first point. The second point is, having personally documented the testimonies of Burundian and Rwandan survivors of genocide and genocide-like activities, I would never privilege one kind of suffering over another. But the fact remains that currently there's almost 250,000 Syrians who have lost their lives. Half of the population has been displaced. This has the ability to destabilize the entire region. This is important to follow up on Bill's point. This is not just an issue of humanitarian assistance. It's also thinking about wider issues that affect the region, and we certainly wouldn't want to see the entire Levant get pulled into a sinkhole. So I think that one could argue strategically, beyond the humanitarian aspect, that there's a need to engage here. So,
In front.
Hello, Todd Scribner from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. At what point, and then also a question, I mean, one thing I would point to in terms of the asylum seeker versus the refugee resettlement situation, I mean, if you look at the southwest border and the way in which the United States has failed to respond effectively to asylum seekers from Central America, I mean, that provides a stark contrast to the way in which Germany has responded, even though we may resettle more people sort of on an annual basis on average. But my question is sort of a larger electoral kind of political identity question. If I'm not mistaken, of the 31 governors that have opposed resettlement of refugees into their state, 30 of them are all but one, I think, is a Democrat. Or is that was a Republican? Well, there's only one Democrat. You look at Donald Trump, obviously he's running for Republican ticket. There seems to be something obviously within the Republican Party that has sort of opposes this kind of issue. And I'm wondering if anyone has any thoughts on sort of, I guess, an historical or maybe a more granular level, the development of conservative identity as it relates and how it's sort of grounded in this kind of oppositional approach to immigration, if there's anything significant about sort of the development of liberalism as we understand it today that may be more open or maybe differently opposed in some respects. So sort of like the bigger kind of electoral political identity issue.
Well, I'm looking at the clock. We have 4.5 minutes left in this session, and you posed questions that I've spent most of my scholarly life studying, and so there's no way I can respond adequately. Although I'd love to have a sidebar conversation with you. I've spent a fair amount of time in some sort of communion with the U.S. Catholic bishops, and I'd be happy to continue it. But it is, I think, an undeniable fact that there are two Americas right now. And unfortunately, those two Americas have sorted themselves out into the two political parties. One political party, just to paint the backdrop here, is on balance comfortable with the profound demographic changes that our country has undergone in the past two generations. And I promise you, even if we slam the immigration gates shut tomorrow, we'll continue to experience at least until the year 2060. So, and the other political party is uncomfortable about these changes and has become a rallying point for people who, for a mix of reasons, understandable and less understandable, pardonable and less pardonable, are worried about what they perceive as a fundamental change in the character of the country as they understand the character of the country. That's the broad backdrop against which this is playing out. Demographic change, political polarization. And throughout our history, there's been a tension between what might be called the universalism of our principles and evolving conceptions of nationalism on the other. This is not the first time we've seen this, and it will not be the last. And we can get through it, but if you remember the what was going on in the late teens and early 20s of the 20th century, if you remember what was going on in the years between 1935 and 1941, the huge nativist and isolationist upsurge in this country, this is another episode in one of the longest running dramas in American history. And I think it has to be viewed in that light.
Bobby? Yeah, just real quickly on this. There's no question that there is certainly a divide between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party on this, and that some of the Republicans are driving this toxic discourse. That being said, I think it would be a mistake, though, to think that this is only a Republican problem. And from my view, I think that there are a lot of Democrats out there, including in my home state, Michigan, that could be doing a whole lot more, and they should be using their platform with a megaphone to try and fight back against some of this. So I don't question how this is being driven, and I don't contest anything that Bill had just so eloquently laid out. But what I do think is that more Democrats can and should be using their positions to try and dispel some of these views. Other than just giving the occasional lip service that Donald Trump is obnoxious. That's not enough in my view. So,
yeah. Well, this is what I love about Brookings, which is we can take a complex issue and approach it from a lot of different angles, bring a lot of very sophisticated research, and do so in a way that we hope leaves us all smarter at the end. So I'd like to thank our panelists, and I'd like to ask you all to join me in a round of applause before we head out.